Last show of the evening, last show of the year, last time in Canada, last chance of your lifetime to see the fantastic Von O work in his powers of mental prestidigitation.
The preacher slapped two whole American quarters on a table and told the white woman sitting there, "Me and my boy want to see the mesmerist." I spoke right up and said, "No, sir. You go on in and see him. I'll wait over yon by that tree." The preacher grabbed hold of my collar and pulled me into the tent. This one didn't have no benches in it to sit down on, so we were standing shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of folks from Chatham. Soon as we were inside and worked our way up to the front, I clapped my hand across my eyes. The preacher put his mouth near my ear and said, "No, sorry, Bob. I paid a whole 25 cents for you to watch this, and that's just what you're going to do." He jerked my hand away from covering my face. The first thing I did was look straight up, partly so's I wouldn't have to see the stage, but mostly 'cause if the preacher was going to force me to watch and get floated off by lightning coming out of some white man's eyes, I wanted to see if there was something I could latch a hold on to before I ended up in the clouds. If I was going to get lifted away, this was a good place to do it, 'cause I couldn't have gotten no higher than the roof of the tent. There were torches high up on the walls that I had to be careful of whilst I was floating, but I figured if I kept a keen eye and kicked at them, I could get by without burning nothing besides my brogans and maybe the cuffs of my trousers. I looked all across the top of the tent, and my heart started slowing down. It was a true relief to see that there weren't no one from the earlier show still stuck up there. Maybe that meant the conjuring wore off after a while, and you'd come a crashing back down. If I'd have known this was going to happen, I'd have brung me a length of rope and tied it around my ankle. That way, if I started floating, the preacher could have pulled me long home like a kite. I'd have felt a lot better about waiting for the conjuring to wear off back in Buxton than here amongst a bunch of strangers. Before I could do any more worrying, a curtain on the stage got whipped aside, and a tall, round white man in a long black cape was standing right in front of us. His eyes looked a whole lot more like a dead person's eyes than a live person's. They were blank and blue, and they appeared to be looking square at you, but you could tell they weren't really seeing a thing. A bevy of laughs and moans and screams came out of everyone that was jammed up in the tent. It ain't being fragile when I say that I was amongst the screamers. I grabbed hold of the preacher's shirt sleeve and mashed my face into it. He just a quick snatched it away and said, "I told you, you were going to watch this. You can learn about how a flim-flam works." I noticed my own arm was being held on too tight and looked to see who'd grab me. A little white stranger boy, near about as old as me, was laughing and carrying on something wild. He swore, "Blanket talk. This here's the fourth time I seen him, and I still near about jump out of my skin when he first come on stage." He talked like he was from America. I said, "You saw him four times? Ain't you afeard of getting floated off?" He laughed and said, "Shh. He just an old humbug. He can't float not nowhere." The boy had a head of thick, curly red hair and a nose that looked a whole lot like a bird's beak. His eyes were scary gray and blue color, about the same as the sky for a storm. He wasn't nothing but a child, but the smell of cigar smoke came out of his mouth strong. I said, "He really can't float nothing away?"
"Nah. Watch what happens. What's your name?"
"I'm Elijah." The boy looked like I cursed at him.
"Elijah, you sure?"
"Course I'm sure."
"You live down in Buxton?"
"Yes."
"Well, I'll tell you something, Elijah. You best not tell no one from Chatham that that's your name."
"Why not?"
"'Cause there's a rapscallion in Chatham what's already laid claim to that name, and he ain't the kind to be sharing nothing with no one. There was a boy up here whose name was Edward,
and Elijah from Chatham didn't want no one else having their name even start with the same first letter as his. So he made the boy change his name to Oddward. And Oddward's own Ma and Pa calls him that now, because they didn't want no trouble with the real Elijah. If I was you, I'd find me another name, because Elijah from Chatham ain't going to be real happy about meeting you, particularly not with you being a slave boy from Buxton.
I was never a slave. I was freeborn.
Don't matter. Just you be mindful of who you say that name to. Elijah from Chatham ain't to be trifled with. He already killed a full-grown Indian man, and didn't kill him with no knife or gun or sword. Killed him with one hand, his left one, and he ain't but 12 years old.
Those words hadn't had no chance to sink in good when the conjurer on stage came to life. He flung his arms to the sides and showed that under his black cape, he was wearing a something blue that looked a powerful lot like a dress with all sorts of shiny, sparkling, silvered stars and crescent moons. Why, it was pasted with as many moons as stars. And that'll make no sense. That'll make no sense at all. All the folks that were screaming and laughing a minute ago set up a mess of oohs and ahs that would have you believing they were seeing the real heavens instead of a dress with sham stars and way too many moons stuck all over it. The little white boy dug his elbow into my ribs and said,
"Keep a watch on his eyes."
The most amazing thing happened. The conjurer's eyes rolled back in his head, and their place was took right away by another set of eyes. Only difference twixt them was that these two eyes were brown, and whilst the other one seemed staring and empty, these eyes were looking dead at you, and worst, weren't no doubt that they were seeing you. I felt my legs commence shaking and grabbed a hold of the white boy so as I wouldn't fall. He said,
"Them first eyes is painted on his lids. I was out back smoking a cigar with him and seen it myself. He ain't real tall."
The conjurer was slow as anything, peering hard at everyone in the crowd. When his eyes hit him, some folks screamed, some folks laughed, some folks cried, and some folks appeared to be dumbstruck. I ain't sure which group I was amongst, because the fearing in me was too strong. The white boy said,
"Watch this. I'm going to have me some fun here."
When the man's eye struck him, the boy stood bolt upright and his face froze stiff as a stone. I quick unloosed his arm so the conjurization wouldn't have the chance to jump off of him and onto me. The man pointed spot on at the boy and called out, "You." The boy's eyes near bucked right out of his head. The conjurer man's finger commenced crooking and bending in a way that got more screams and confusion to rise up from the crowd. The boy looked at me. His face unfroze for a second, and one of his gray eyes winked. Then, quick as anything, his face froze up again, looking all stupefied, and he started pushing his way through people and heading to the steps on the side of the stage. You'd have thought the conjurer's finger was a magnet and the boy was made out of iron filings. When folks saw the spell he was under, they stepped aside like he was toting a bucket that was overflowing with the plague. He got up on the stage, and the conjurer waved his cape over the boy's head twice. He said,
"Boy, do you know me?"
The boy said,
"No, sir. You's a perfect stranger."
"Then we've never spoken."
"No, sir. And I ain't never smoked no cigar with you behind the tent, neither."
Some folks that didn't know how frightsome this was laughed, and the conjurer screamed out, "Silence!
Do you not see that this boy is already under a spell and talking nonsense? Why, if I were to misdirect my attention away from him for merely one moment, he'd be in danger of remaining a babbling idiot like this for the rest of his life."
The conjurer man talked like he came from England. Most folks got quiet, like they were in church. The conjurer waved his cape over the boy's head again and said,
"Look into my eyes. Look deeply into my eyes."
The boy couldn't help himself. He looked, and the conjurer started blinking first one eye, then the other, so's on one side of his face you were seeing a live brown eye, and on the other side you were seeing a dead blue one. Then he opened both dead eyes at once, then both live ones, till by and by your head was back to whirling, and you know this boy had been wrong. This conjurer was real. I snatched back a hold of the preacher's coat sleeve. The conjurer said, "Look even more deeply into my eyes." The boy's head started going back and forth fast, like a pendulum in a clock that the weights fell off. Then his chin dropped down on his chest, and it appeared he was out cold, excepting he didn't fall in a heap. The man said, "You are entering a realm of velvet sleep, golden slumbers, and dappled dreams. Once I snap my fingers, you will lose yourself in my voice. Upon the sound of my fingers snapping, my simplest wish will become your irresistible command." He slow raised his right hand over his head, waited for what felt like was an hour, then snapped his fingers. At the same exact time, someone banged a drum one terrible boom, and a flash of red and yellow powder exploded and popped and hissed all along the front of the stage. Screams and smoke from the powder rised up to the top of the tent, and truth told, my scream was amongst the loudest and longest lasting. The conjurer said, "When I count to three, you will open your eyes and hear no voice other than mine. One, two, three." He snapped his fingers again, and the boy's eyes came open and was staring direct at the conjurer. I know the poor boy was under the man's spell, 'cause one of his eyeballs started looking right, whilst the other one was looking left. Then they commenced going in circles and rolling back in his head. My blood ran cold thinking about how this boy thought this was all a flim-flam, and now he'd gone and let this horrible-looking man snatch a hold of his soul. I knowed it weren't going to be long afore this poor white boy would be scratching and clawing at the roof of the tent. The conjurer said, "What is your name, boy?" The boy started talking slow, having a hard time getting the words out.
"My maw named me Samuel, but most folks calls me Sammy."
"Samuel, who is the only person in the entire world whom you can trust?"
"You, master."
"That's right. And do you believe everything I say?"
"Like your mouth's a prayer book, master."
"Then why are you speaking to me in English? You are not a little boy. You are a chicken. And unless the chickens in Canada are very much brighter than American chickens, they do not speak English."
'Twas the most amazing thing. The little boy started clucking and pecking round on the stage. Then he commenced scratching at the floor with his bare feet, and you have swore he was digging up worms. Near everybody in the tent acted like this was something funny. None of them thought to worry what Sammy's ma was going to say when the son she sent to the carnival as a little boy came home as a giant bird, and even worse, a giant chicken. The conjurer waved his cape again and called out,
"You are no longer a chicken. You are a boy again. But wait, the weather has changed. It's positively freezing in here."
Why, the boy took to shivering and teeth chattering and knee knocking so doggone much that I felt a chill of coldness run down my back. And this wasn't no flim-flam neither, 'cause Sammy started turning blue the way they say white people do when they're dead or just about ready to die. The mesmerist yelled,
"Ye gods, this Canadian weather! 1 second it's freezing, and the next it's like the fires of Hades. This heat is enough to kill."
Sammy quit shivering and commenced wiping his brow and pulling at the collar of his shirt and saying,
"Whew!"
So you'd have thought he'd just got done plowing 50 acres in the middle of July with a mouse for a mule harness to a knife for a plow. Folks laughed and screamed so much that you could see why this cost a whole quarter of our American dollar to come in and see. The mesmerist said,
"And what's that I see right in front of you, young Samuel? It appears to be the waters of Lake Erie, cool and deep and inviting."
Sammy started brushing at the stage like it was covered with sand, and he was clearing a spot to spread a blanket. But afore he could set himself down, the mesmerist said with a voice that was fooled up with disappointment,
"Samuel, Samuel, Samuel."
Sammy froze up, and the man told him,
"How can you even think of relaxing at the seashore when you are just a very few feet away from bathing in this great lake's waters? You should jump right in."
Sammy slapped his own forehead like he was thinking,
"How come I didn't think of that?"
and stuck one of his toes out to test the water. He let out a long, "Ah!" and got ready to put his whole foot in this lake that couldn't no one but him and the conjurer man see. Afore even his ankles got wet, the mesmerist said,
"Samuel, Samuel, Samuel."
Sammy didn't step no farther into the water, and the conjurer looked at all of us who were watching and said,
"Have any of you here ever heard of a boy going to bathe fully clothed?"
The crowd shouted out of one throat, "No!" I kept my eye on Sammy, and for a second, the dumbstruck look flew off his face, and his brow wrinkled. But just as quick, he went back to looking stupefied. The mesmerist said,
"Of course not. Particularly not when you are wearing the finest silk shirt that the most talented tailor in Toronto has to offer. Samuel, your mother would be appalled if you were to get that beautiful, expensive, and rather stylish shirt wet."
Sammy slapped his forehead again and started pulling the shirt over his head. Once he had it off, he went wearing nothing but a raggedy undershirt and commenced tiptoeing back into the lake. But afore the water could cover even his knees, the mesmerist said it again,
"Samuel, Samuel, Samuel."
Sammy stopped with one foot in the air and looked back at the conjurer.
"My word, ladies and gentlemen, would you look at this young man? He is a stubborn and ungrateful lad. Not only has his dear, beloved mother seen fit to clothe him in a fine silken shirt, she's also given him a silk undershirt. Please, Samuel, off with it, before it's ruined by the waters of Lake Erie."
This time, Sammy cut a look at the mesmerist that weren't the least bit dumbstruck. It was kind of edging on being worried. He pulled his undershirt over his head, and a bail of laughs echoed round the tent. Laughing is a peculiar thing, 'cause there are lots of different kinds. There's a laughing you do at the end of a good story, a laugh you give when you're scared to find out you didn't have no cause to be, and the laughing that was bouncing around in this tent. It wasn't a happy kind of sound at all. It mostly reminded me of the cutting sounds that a pack of hounds makes once they commence to ripping a possum to shreds. It was more like the sound you'd think the devil would make if he had a good sense of humor and you told him a joke. I weren't doing none of the kinds of laughing. I could see that if this started out being fun for Sammy, it sure was turning into something else. Ma and Pa must be right about what smoking does to a child, because once his undershirt was off, we could see Sammy was right skinny and sickly looking. And though standing in front of all these people without no kind of shirt on at all would have shamed me near to death, the conjuration was on him so strong that Sammy kept on doing it. But it did seem like his enthusiasm for the whole show was getting littler and littler. He hugged his arms round himself and started back to tiptoeing into Lake Erie. But Sammy gave a long, pulled-out groan when the mesmerist and most of the folks in the crowd moaned out, "Samuel, Samuel, Samuel." A hoop and a holler came out of the crowd, because we were all pretty sure that even though Sammy's trousers looked like old and worn-out dungarees to us, to the mesmerist, there were going to be some more of that fine Toronto silk that can't stand getting wet.
"Ye gods, boy, I've never seen such a privileged yet undeserving child. Your mother's love for you knows no bounds. Silken trousers as well. Can you believe it?"
This time, the stupefied look left Sammy and a fearedness and shaming took over. The red from his hair started leaking down onto the rest of his face. His ears started up glowing like hot pokers. But he turned his back to the crowd and started unbuttoning those trousers. He held up once they're all unbuttoned, but the mesmerist had no mercy in him at all. He waved his cape and said, "Off with the silken trousers!" Sammy gave a gulp so loud everyone in the tent heard it. Then he let loose of his pants, and they dropped right round his ankles. The crowd sucked in air, then got real quiet, except for one man who hollered out,
"Shucks, if his darn ma loved him so darn much, you'd think she'd have bought the boy some kind of underdraws, silk or not."
The laughs and howls and hoots must have raised the roof of the tent 5 feet, all 'cause Sammy was naked as the day he was born. And he turned red as any cardinal I'd ever seen. I'd druther have got floated into the ceiling for 2 hours than to stand there like that for 2 seconds. The mesmerist's mouth flew open, and he quick clopped Sammy in the head, then pulled his cape round him and said,
"The spell's over. Pull your pants up, you little chowderhead. Have you lost your blasted mind?"
After they rough-handed Sammy and booted him out of the tent, the conjurer mesmerized 2 or 3 other folks, but weren't a one of them nowhere near as interesting as Sammy. It must have been getting near midnight when me and the preacher left the tent, and he said,
"When we get to this next place, just go along with everything I say, and fight that urge of yours to talk so much. Don't open your mouth unless you're spoken to."
"Yes, sir." We walked a little ways into the woods and sat on a couple of stumps whilst folks cleared out of the carnival. Finally, the preacher said,
"Let's go. And remember, the less you say, the better."
Chapter 10 Meeting the Real Maui.
Me and the preacher wandered round the carnival for about another hour. Then we walked back into the Atlas clearing and headed for a tent where most of the carnival workers were sitting. A big, rough-looking white man with bright red hair stood up and put his hand on the preacher's chest and said,
"A show's over, boy. We's pulling up stakes tonight and don't need no more workers."
The preacher slapped the man's hand off his chest and stood so his jacket was open and that mystery pistol was showing. He said,
"I look like a boy to you. I'm not here about work. I'm looking for the owner, and if you put another hand on me, you'll be pulling back a bloody stump."
The tall conjurer man with the 2 sets of eyes jumped up and said,
"Hold on a moment, Red. I own this carnival, sir. How may I help you?"
The preacher pushed past the red-haired white man and said,
"Sir,
I just want to start by telling you what a wonderful carnival you have here."
The conjurer reached his hand to the preacher and said,
"Why, thank you, sir. Whom do I have the honor of addressing?"
"I'm the Right Reverend Deacon Dr. Zaphariah Connerly III. A pleasure to meet you, sir."
"Reverend Connerly, I am humbled to be in your presence. I am the lowly Charles Mondial Vaughan IV, Knight Commander of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath, knighted a mere 14 years ago."
The preacher said, "I'm the one who's humbled, sir. I've been to many such carnivals and have never seen anything that matches this one. You must be very proud."
"Indeed, indeed. I've worked years to assemble this family."
The preacher said, "Which is why I wanted to speak with you."
The conjurer took a long pull on his cigar and blew the smoke to the side, then said,
"And what may I do for you, sir?"
"It's more what I can do for you."
"I'm intrigued. Do tell."
The preacher pulled me from behind him and said, "Sir Charles, allow me to introduce the most amazing child ever to have lived in Buxton. Although he was born and reared in Africa, he has lived with me for these past 4 years. Maybe in your travels you've heard of the tribe he's from, the Chochotes."
Sir Charles said,
"Can't say that I have."
"There's a reason you haven't. Sad to say, little Abo here is the last surviving member."
"Well, Reverend, that is indeed sad. But what does that have to do with my carnival?"
The preacher commenced waving his arms, really warming into this tale he's about to spin.
"The Chochotes were fierce warriors who hunted and even fished with nothing but stones. Stone throwing was a skill passed from generation to generation, and little Abo's father, who was the king of the Chochotes, passed on the secrets of stone hunting and fishing to his son, just before he was tragically murdered."
The preacher sounded so heart-busted about this that even I was getting sad for little Abo, and I know that he was me, and that there weren't probably going to be a lick of truth in the whole story.
The conjurer said, "Pity that. But wait, do I understand you to be saying that this boy can catch a fish underwater by throwing a stone?"
The preacher said, "If only we were at a lake so he could show you."
The conjurer winked at the big, rough, red-haired white man and said,
"If he can do that, he must have an unusually keen eye. Could he, mayhap, demonstrate his skill some other way?"
"Of course he can. I watched your Madame Sabah earlier tonight, and while she was most impressive, I didn't see her doing anything little Abo couldn't match."
"No?"
"No. Perhaps we could go to her tent and show you."
"Well, sir, we were actually preparing to break things down, but I think little Abo might provide an interesting but brief diversion."
The preacher, Sir Charles, and the other white man started walking toward the slingshot lady's tent with me trailing behind. The conjurer looked back at me and said loud and slow,
"Do you speak any English?"
It was kind of hard to look at him with his two sets of eyes, but I said,
"Why, yes, sir, and some Latin, and I can understand a little Greek."
"Oops. That must have been too much talking."
The preacher gave me a hard look, then told the conjurer,
"Plus, of course, he's fluent in Chochote."
One of the conjurer's eyebrows raised up, and he said,
"Indeed. To my ear, it sounds as if the boy is very Canadian."
"Well, that's because not only is he the best stone flinger since David, he's also uncommonly bright. He's lived with me for only 4 years, and he's picked up the language and customs of Canada West so quickly, it's truly astounding."
All of a sudden, a stranger boy came up alongside of me and gave me some unpleasant looks. His hair was all matted up like a bird's nest, and his clothes were so dirty
that not even Cuda would have been caught dead in him. He said, "Who you?" I just about said my name, then remembered what Sammy had told me about saying Elijah around here. I know the boy weren't from Buxton, and I was pretty sure he weren't from Chatham, but I couldn't be total for certain. I thought it'd be best if I didn't take no chances. He was littler than me, so I said, "Why you want to know?" He said, "Where y'all going?" He sounded American. "Over to the Slingshot Lady's tent." The boy spit, kicked his bare foot out the dirt, and said, "I knowed it." I could tell he was sizing me up to see if he could lick me. I puffed my chest up some whilst we walked. The boy said quiet, "I's the real Mal Wee. But you's fixin' to take my place, ain't you?" "What?" "That white boy wasn't no good. I seen it. So now Master Charles looking for you to take my place." He tilted his head toward the conjurer and said, "He done told me it was just for whilst we's in Canada, but I knowed he was a lying."
"Lying about what?"
"You's trying to be the next Mal Wee, ain't you?"
"What?"
"But I'ma tell you right now that you ain't gonna like it. You ain't gonna like roaming about with him one bit. They ain't gonna say nothing at first, but you gonna have to clean all them animal cages and fetch for him all times of the day or night. And the gator man gonna beat you every chance he get, and you gonna be cleaning all their clothes, and they stingy with what they feed you. And it even ain't no fun after a while getting hit in the face with them graves, neither." I said, "I'm not taking no one's place. The preacher's just bragging on me so's that man with all those eyes can see how good I chunk stones." The boy gave me another rough look. I said, "You travel around with these people?" "Course I do. I told you, I'm the real Mal Wee." "Your ma and pa travel with you, too?" "I ain't got no ma nor pa."
"You a orphan?"
"You best watch what you's calling me." "What's an orphan?"
I said, "How old are you?"
"I ain't sure."
"You ain't had no schooling at all?"
"What I need schooling for? You ask too much questions."
"Who takes care of you?"
"Master Charles do. He look after me good. He done paid more than $100 for me down in Louisiana."
"Paid? You a slave?"
"Nah. I seen how slaves get treated. I ain't no slave."
"You ain't never tried to escape?"
"What you mean? If Master cut me loose, what's I gonna eat? Where I gonna sleep?"
"But this is Canada. You ain't but 3 miles from Buxton. You ain't never heard of Buxton?"
"Master Charles say Buxton why he have to get a white boy to pretend he Mal Wee. He say y'all up here ain't gonna think it funny to see me get pelt with no grapes. Now he think that white boy ain't no good, and he gonna try you next."
I told him, "My ma and pa ain't about to let me travel with no circus. Buxton's my home." The inside of Madame Sabar's tent looked a whole lot smaller without all the people piled up in it. Madame Sabar herself was sitting on the stage smoking a cigar. Mal Wee pointed at the white cloth atop the jungle board and whispered,
"Can y'all read? What that say?"
I told him, "It says, 'The Jungles of Sweden.'"
"It don't say nothing about Mal Wee?"
"No."
"That what I thought. He lie."
The preacher and the conjurer stopped talking, and Sir Charles told Mal Wee,
"Go light the candles as if it's a show."
"Yes, sir."
Mal Wee struck a match and set all the candles on the board burning.
"Them other ones too, boss?"
"Yes, everything."
Maul Wee grabbed a lighting pole and went round the tent, lighting the candles up high. When he was done, he came back and said, "That all, boss?"
"Yes, Maul Wee. But don't leave. We're getting started in a moment."
"Yes, sir, boss."
"Now, Reverend Connolly, perhaps a little Arbo can demonstrate his skill."
The preacher waited for me to come up on the stage. He whispered to me,
"First time through, just use your right hand."
This weren't gonna be nothing. It weren't even 20 paces twixt me and the candles that were sitting atop the Swedish jungle board. I reached in my tote sack and pulled out 10 of the chunking stones and set them on the table next to me. I looked at the preacher, and he ducked his head at me. I held on to my breathing and chunked with my right hand and passed stones into it with my left. When I was done, all the candles had been put out just as smooth as the slingshot lady had done it. The conjurer and the other white man looked at each other. Madame Sabar blowed a long cloud of smoke out of her nose holes. The preacher winked his eye at me. Maul Wee called out,
"Woo-wee! He good, Master Charles. Y'all can't use him for nothing but tossing stones. He that good."
The conjurer said,
"You're right, Maul Wee. That was most remarkable. Now, how about the others?"
He pointed at the higher up candles. This weren't going to be as easy. The farthest candles appeared to be about 30-35 paces away, and it was dark up that high. The preacher saw I was fretting and came up on the stage.
"What's wrong?"
"I don't know if I can put out the flames on the two at the back, sir."
"Just aim to knock them down, then."
"Yes, sir." "Just my right hand again?"
"Yes."
I held on to my breathing and threw at the 12 candles rung round the tent. When I was done, one of them at the back had got knocked over, and I'd clean missed on the one over the doorway. Sir Charles and the other white man brung their heads together and started talking. Maul Wee said,
"Master Charles, Master Charles, you got to have that boy take over for Mrs. Sabar. He good enough to take her place."
The preacher said,
"And that's not half the story, Sir Charles. No disrespect intended, madam, but while you are without doubt a deadly accurate slingshotist, little Arbo's skills include something else."
The preacher's hands started unfolding and waving right along with the story. He said,
"One of the reasons the Chochote tribe is nearly wiped from the face of the earth is that they shared their land with an insect so vile that it is called the horrible giant bomber bee. Bees so large that they've been known to carry away a full-grown man as easily as a hawk carries a mouse. And they attack in swarms of 10, which forced the Chochote to learn to throw not only with accuracy, but with speed as well. Might I propose, if she's not too tired, that Madame Sabar and little Arbo have a side-by-side demonstration that includes speed?"
Sir Charles said,
"A race? Why, that might prove to be quite interesting. Madam?"
The slingshot lady didn't look too happy about doing this, but she chomped her teeth on her cigar and stood next to me. The preacher said,
"If the young boy could light the 10 candles on the board again, we can get this started."
Maul Wee waited till Sir Charles nodded at him, then lit up all the candles. The preacher said,
"Why doesn't the madam pick one side of the board and put out candles toward the middle, and little Arbo will do the same with the other side? We'll see who puts out the most, the quickest."
The woman chomped her cigar harder and said, "Left." She raised her slingshot. The preacher whispered to me,
"Use both hands. Beat her good."
He told Sir Charles,
"You start them."
The conjurer man said,
"Both of you start on the count of three.
One. Two.
Folks from Sweden must not be real good accounting. The conjurer hadn't even finished saying two before Madame Sabar put out the first candle on the left.
Three.
I throwed left, right, left, right, left, right. I'd got six of them in the time she got four. She spit her cigar out on the stage and said, "Light them candles up again, you little fool." Ma-wee waited on the conjurer to nod, then lit them all up. This time, I got seven, and she got three. She knocked one of them over, too. She dropped her slingshot and walked out of the tent. Ma-wee shouted, "Ooh-wee! He done run her off! He way better than her. You gonna let him take her place?" The conjurer said,
"My word, Reverend, you didn't exaggerate in the least. I think little Arbor will fit very nicely into our family."
Ma-wee said, "He gonna take her place, boss? I ain't never seen no one would throw so good. Lots of folks pay to see that boy throw. It'd be a waste of time having him get pelt with grapes."
The conjurer said, "Start breaking things down in here, boy. I want to leave by noon tomorrow. Red, go see if Madame Sabar is all right. Reverend, we need to talk."
Him and the preacher stood next to the stage. Sir Charles said,
"I assume you've had some expenses in raising little Arbo. I'm willing to give you some consideration for that. You say the poor lad is an orphan."
"Yes, I'm the only one he has."
"How much are you looking for, sir?"
The preacher said,
"Hold on here. You've misjudged me. I don't deal in human beings."
"Then what is it you're proposing?"
"The boy and I would be willing to travel with you for a while, if you're willing to make certain guarantees."
"Such as?"
"Such as how much we would be paid. Such as what it is we would do in your family. Such as what it is we wouldn't do."
Sir Charles blowed out another long puff of cigar smoke at the roof of the tent and said,
"Ah. Well, Reverend, what is it you propose doing? I can see that little Arbor would be able to carry his weight and contribute to the family with his stone-throwing, augmented, of course, by several other chores. But I really do not have a need for anyone else. I would, however, handsomely reward you for your transference of guardianship of the boy."
Ma-weed pulled all the candles off the top of the sweetened jungle board. He said,
"Pardon me, boss. You wants me to take this sign about that white boy off of here? We gonna put it back saying this here's the real Ma-weed's jungle, ain't we?"
The conjurer man kept his eyes on the preacher but nodded his head at Ma-wee. Ma-wee pulled off the white sheet that said the jungles of Sweden. Writ out underneath the sheet in letters direct on the board was, "The jungles of darkest Africa. Help Madame Sabar capture Ma-wee, the chief of the Pickaninnies." All of a sudden, the preacher was done talking. He grabbed hold of my collar, and we marched out the front of the tent. Afore you could blink, we're walking down the road back to Buxton. Things happened so quick that I had to ask the preacher, "Why'd we leave without saying goodbye to no one?" He said,
"It wasn't what I thought it was."
"What'd you think it was? Wasn't it just a carnival?"
"Forget this happened. It was a bad idea from the start."
"What was?"
"Nothing, Elijah. I was simply looking for a way to help the settlement."
I tried a couple more times, but I weren't getting no more explaining from the preacher. It appeared he didn't want to talk no more, which I look at as he wanted to do some listening. So I told him all about Sammy
and how scared I was about getting floated away, and about how Sir Charles paid $100 American for Marwee. I kept on talking all the way to Buxton, but the only subject the preacher seemed to take any kind of interest in at all was Marwee. He had me tell him about it 3 times. I asked the preacher if you were still a slave if you didn't mind working for someone and didn't have nowhere else to go. Only thing he said was,
"Yes, you're still a slave, but you're worse than a slave. You're an ignorant slave."
When we got home, the preacher waited whilst I climbed in through my bedroom window. Once I got in, I waved at him, and he waved back and walked away. It weren't till I was in bed thinking about the most exciting day I'd ever had in my life that it came to me that the preacher headed back down the road to Chatham, instead of toward his own home. That was just as peculiar as a whole lot of things the preacher did that night. I just chalked it up to some more of that groaned-up behavior that don't make no sense. It don't make no sense at all. On Monday morning, me and Cuda joined up in front of the schoolhouse. I was about to explode, wanting to tell him some more about the carnival. But before I could open my mouth, he said,
"Don't it seem odd? Ain't no one else there?" "Doggone it all, Elijah. The same thing happened to me last month, when I lost track of the days and sat out here for a half an hour on Sunday morning, wondering where everyone was at. Today is Monday, ain't it?"
"Yes. Don't you remember sitting in church all day yesterday?"
"So where's Everett?"
We both heard someone say, "Ooh," and walked around back of the school. All the other children were crowded up in a big circle way out in the field. Wouldn't no one dare fight this close to the school, so me and Cuda ran over to see what the commotion was. I said, "I bet they found another dead body." Cuda said,
"Uh-uh. Emma Collins is standing there, and she'd have run off and told someone first thing. I bet one of them moth lions from that circus you was telling me about busted loose, and they's holding him down till someone come to get it."
I looked at Cuda and couldn't help hoping that thick-headedness ain't something you can catch like a cold. When we busted into the circle, it wasn't neither a dead body nor a lion. 'Twas a little stranger boy standing there looking like he's about to cry. I knowed this boy, but I couldn't get a hold on from where. Then it hit me. 'Twas Marwee. Somebody had cut all his wild hair off and put him in some proper clothes. I said, "You escaped. You're free." 'Twa'n't odd for folks had just got free to look and act confused, but I had never saw no one that looked and acted like they were mad about coming to live in Buxton afore. And Marwee was good and mad. Why, he was pouting and looking like he had rocks in his jaws and was grumbling so's everyone was wondering if he was crazy. Emma Collins asked him,
"What? You're wishing you hadn't escaped? You're wishing you were still a slave?"
Marwee rubbed his hand over the top of his head like he was still wondering where all his hair was at.
"I don't tell you, I wasn't no slave, and I didn't do no escaping neither. I got snatched off by his friend."
He pointed spot on at me. I said,
"What?"
"After y'all left, your friend come back and stole me from Master Charles."
I couldn't help myself. I knowed I should have kept my mouth shut, but I said,
"The preacher?"
Marwee said, "Preacher? He sure don't act like no preacher I ever seen."
Cuda said,
"What happened?"
"Soon's we got done breaking everything down, that friend of his bust in holding on to 2 guns and set to pistol whipping Massa Red. Then he grabbed Master Charles's hair like he about to scalp him.
He shoves one of them guns right in Master Charles's nose. We all thinking it gonna be another stick-up, and bosses show a fear of this man and say, ain't no need to hurt no one, just take the money. But that there boy's friend, Ma Wee pointed right at me, say he ain't looking to rob us. And then he point the gun what ain't jammed up Master Charles's nose dead in me. He tell the gator man he got 1 minute to tie my hands up. All the time, he got that pistol up at Master Charles' nose so deep, blood running down his face. Tears were pouring out of Malwee's eyes. Once the gator man got me roped good, that preacher tell him this here's Canada, and folks is free, and he taking me to Buxton, and he gonna kill anyone would try to stop him. Then he tell Master Charles that once we gets to Buxton, y'all's army gonna make sure don't no one come and try to get me back. He say he got him the fastest horse in Canada tied out in the woods, but it weren't gonna be no different if he had an old broke-down mule, 'cause he ain't gonna gallop him nor trot him nor rush him at all. He say he ain't about to run from no one, especially not in his own country. Then he tell Master Charles the way to come if he want to find where y'all live. He tell him that the road to Buxton branch off to the right about half a mile down, and if they daft enough to follow him and wants to meet the Lord that bad, then that the way they got to turn. Everybody was looking shocked at Malwee's story. He wiped his nose on his shirt sleeve and said, then he pulled me out of the tent and took me off into the woods and put me on top that pretty horse and tied me to the saddle and tied them reins round his waist and put one of them pistols in each his hands, and we starts walking right down the middle of the road. I just know Master Charles and them gonna come rescue me, and I'm hoping when they kill that man, their aim's good, and they don't shoot me by mistake. Malwee kicked at the ground and said, only thing I can figure is, they took the wrong branch once they come to where the road split up at. But don't none y'all be surprised if they come busting in that there schoolhouse and take me back with them. Emma Collins said, why are you wishing for that? You're free now. Ma Wee said, how's I free when they told me I ain't got no choice but to go to school? How's I free when they got that Johnny boy and his mama watching over me like a sheriff? The bell rung, and it came to me that I was going to have to be careful with Ma Wee. If Emma Collins or one of them other girls got wind that I was wandering about past midnight at the carnival, they'd get me stewed up in a world of trouble. As we walked up the steps into the schoolhouse, Mr. Travis said,
a good morning, scholars, strivers, and questers for a better future. Are you ready to learn? Are you ready to grow?
He saw Malwee and said,
well, congratulations. They told me you'd be joining us today. Welcome, young man.
I could tell being free was going to be a hard road to hoe for Malwee. Instead of answering Mr. Travis in the proper way, he, bold as anything, said to him,
how many people in y'all's army anyway?
Children jumped to the side and cleared out of the way so as not to interfere with Mr. Travis getting a proper snatch at Malwee. But Mr. Travis surprised us. He didn't cane Malwee, nor scold him, nor buke him in the least. He gentle laid his hand on Malwee's head and, without no sting in his voice at all, said,
my name is Mr. Travis. When I call on you to speak, you will address me as that or as sir. I have a feeling you and I are going to be spending a great deal of time together. Once again, welcome and congratulations.
Malwee said,
Thank you, sir.
Both me and him kept peeking out the window all through the day, waiting for Sir Charles and the rough, red-haired white man to come. But they never did show.
Chapter 11 Emma Collins and Bertie.
It was early Saturday morning, a week after the carnival, and Paul and old Flapjack and me and Cooter were down on Mrs. Holton's land uprooting stumps. Everything was going fine, when all of a sudden, old Flap gave one of them snorts that let me know he'd seen something or smelled something that weren't regular. Deers and other four-legged animals ain't nothing to him, so I knowed this sound was for a stranger. A person stranger. I kept guiding old Flap along, tugging his reins as he leaned into the chains that were snatching at the stump. But I cut my eyes across the field to find what it was that got him snorting. I spotted him in the tree line. Folks that are trying to hide in the woods that ain't real comforted being there always make the same mistake. If you want to know exactly where they're at without doing a whole lot of searching, all you gotta do is find the biggest tree or rock around. They always think that behind it is the best place to hide. Whoever these folks were, they choose the biggest maple standing on Mrs. Holton's land. I saw two heads peeking out from amongst the green behind the maple about 50 yards off. I kept working and whistling old Flap on, pretending I hadn't seen nothing at all. I said, "Paul, old Flapjack just got wind of some folks in the trees off to the east." Paul didn't quit working, nor look round, nor act like I talked to him. He just said,
"Is they white?"
"No, sir."
"How many of them is they?"
"All I saw was two, sir. Looks like a man and a boy." Paul said,
"Cuda, head on back and find where Emma Collins is at. Tell her she need it. Don't be looking back, and once you're out of sight, run hard."
Cuda knowed why Paul wanted Emma, so he said, "Yes, sir," and acted like he was strolling away. It seems peculiar, but we had to act like this so didn't no one get spooked. Most times, when new free slaves come to Buxton, they get help here by an underground railroad conductor. But every once in a while, they find us all on their own. When that happens, someone usually spots amongst the trees or bushes, stealing looks and studying us hard, not sure if it's safe to get noticed. Even if they ain't seeing no white people, they still can't bring themselves to show who they are. We learnt a long time ago not to make no big commotion when we first see 'em. We learnt that all the running they've been doing, all the looking over their shoulders and not knowing when they were going to eat again or where they were going to sleep or who they could trust, made 'em skittish and even dangerous and not likely to take to no one running at 'em. Not even if you were smiling or waving and showing how happy you were that they got through. Afore you'd reach 'em, they'd just melt back into the woods, and you'd be standing there wondering if you'd really seen anything at all. If a bunch of us went charging at 'em, whooping and raising Cain, they might disappear back into the forest for another 2 or 3 days. And that was 2 or 3 days that they were free but didn't know it, which Paul says is tragical, 'cause you ain't never gonna know how much time you got here on earth, and each day you're free is precious. That's why after we tried a slew of other things, we found the best way to welcome new free folks to the settlement was to use that crying little brat Emma Collins. Cuda weren't gone for no time at all and came back towing Emma with him. Cradled up in her arm, she was holding on to her doll. It weren't nothing but an old sock that someone had jammed stuffing up inside the toe pot and then tied string tight round and round the neck to turn it into a head. It had 2 big brown buttons sewed on for eyes and 6 little white buttons sewed on for teeth. It even had a bunch of braided black yarn sewed on for hair that was supposed to look like plaits. Em had gone and put little ribbons on the end of each plait and had made the doll a blue dress and a red apron.